I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Yesterday was the anniversary of the day, 30 years ago, when the Khmer Rouge marched into Cambodia's capital city, Phnom Penh. Hundreds of thousands of people, most of those who were educated, were forced into the streets and eventually into rural labor camps. Over the next 4 years, some 2 million people were killed. They starved to death, they were tortured, beaten, and clubbed into pits that became known to the rest of the world as the Killing Fields. 30 years ago, yesterday, Luang Ung was a 5-year-old girl playing hopscotch when her family was uprooted. Her memoir, telling of the destruction of her own family, is called First They Killed My Father. Today she joins us to reflect on the 30th anniversary of the killing in Cambodia and to talk about her new book. It's called Lucky Child. It picks up the story with her emigration to the U.S., her education here, and the parallel life of her older sister, Ju, who stayed behind in Cambodia. I would like to have you join our conversation. We note the anniversaries of events like the Khmer Rouge's rise to power. We read the books and we mourn for the victims, but still such events continue. Since Cambodia, we've seen the same thing happen in Rwanda. It's happening right now in Darfur, Sudan. So what is to be done? Are tribunals and international criminal courts necessary for such countries to move forward? Can the story of what happened to one family in Cambodia make a difference? Can it change the way we see violence in the world today? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Luang Ung joins me now in the Connection Studios. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm wondering what was going through your mind yesterday, knowing that it was the 30th anniversary of that day when you saw the Khmer Rouge come into Phnom Penh.
I was trying to be very strong yesterday, and was giving a talk at the Concord Bookshop. In the midst of my talk, I broke down and cried. It was so heartbreaking to know that 30 years since the Khmer Rouge take over, no one, not a single Khmer Rouge leader, anybody, has been held accountable, punished for the crimes they committed against genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes.
You've made the observation before, too, that when anniversaries like this come by, it reminds you of the day that you heard of Pol Pot's death as well. Was that something you were thinking about yesterday at all?
No, I was. It's also my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Yesterday, the day of the anniversary, April 17th, was also my birthday. And I remember, in Cambodia, we didn't celebrate birthdays, so it wasn't important. But I came to America in 1980, and the birthday custom is so important. And every year, for many years, I would look forward to celebrating life. 2 days before my birthday, on April 15th, 1998, I woke up with the news, hearing the news that Pol Pot had died. It crushed me. I remember being in my office.
Is this because he didn't die in jail? He died before he'd ever been to a court or ever been held to account for leading the Khmer Rouge?
And I was going through it. I had a patchwork of emotions in me, and it was all of that. But more importantly for me, it was that life went on as normal for everybody else, and time stopped for me at that moment. I remember very specifically outside the greens of the buds on the trees and the birds chirping and people walking outside of my office door laughing, talking, drinking coffee. And yet in my office, I curled up into a fetal position and I just sobbed. Time stood still. And yet, you know, for me, the world was talking about Pol Pot and giving him a eulogy in a way by sharing his story, by telling the stories of his life. And yet, the 2 million Cambodians that died as a result of this man's life, this man's work, lay silent in the many killing fields and the many mass graves in Cambodia. And it enraged me that he got to be heard, he got to be known, and yet his victims have been silent and most likely without a tribunal will be silent forever.
Not just the number 2 million, but your family members. Now, for people who have not read the book, First They Killed My Father, you went to the countryside and your older sister was the first to be killed. She died in a labor camp alone by herself. She was how old at the time?
She was 14.
And after that, your father, what happened then?
You know, my father was a former military officer, so we knew he would be in danger. We knew that he was on the Khmer Rouge target hit list. And to try to keep ourselves safe, we went from one village to another, taking different names, living in hidings. But I always knew that we couldn't run forever. And yet, despite knowing that, when the soldiers came, the two soldiers with their guns and the grenades and their excuses, and they said they needed him to go remove an ox cart stuck in the mud with them, I knew it would be the last time I would see him. And as he picked each one of us up and he held us, and I rest my face on the nape of his neck, and I smelt him, I held him. And when he put me down and he walked away with the soldiers on either side of him, the gods had painted the sky that night with a glorious sunset of gold and pink and magenta and orange. I hated the world. I wonder how there could be so much beauty when there was only hell in my world. And all that night and in the next few days, I didn't pray for him to escape. I didn't pray for him to return to me. And when we were told he was executed, I prayed only that his death was quick and painless. And I was 7 years old.
In that same year, your mother sent you away under circumstances that I just can't imagine. She said, go away, I don't want you anymore. And you didn't even know at the time that it was her way of trying to save you.
I didn't know the Khmer Rouge policy or its politics. I was so young. And later on, just through research, I found out that the Khmer Rouge weren't just going around the countryside and gathering the doctors and lawyers and politicians and having these people killed en masse. They were still seeing traitors. So they went after the wives and the children of the people they've killed. And that included people like my families and my mother. I didn't know this, but my mother did. And she gathered all my siblings around, and there were four of us at with her at the time. I was barely 8, and my sister was 10, and my brother was 12, and she said, you gotta leave. You can't stay. I don't want you. I can't take care of you. You're too much trouble.
But she didn't hug you. She didn't sort of bend down and give you a big hug to say goodbye. That was the part
No.
that...
It was... And she turned me by my shoulders and swatted me on the bottom and said, get out. Don't come back. Go find an orphanage camp and tell them that I'm dead. Pretend you're an orphan. She didn't hug me because she knew that if she did, I wouldn't have left. I would have stayed. I would have held onto her skirt. But she made me so angry. She made me believe that maybe I was too much trouble. And maybe she didn't love me enough to sacrifice for me. And so I stomped off full of hate and anger and rage. And in a large part, she saved my life by doing that.
These are the stories that are told in your first book, First They Killed My Father. And we're going to talk in a moment about your new book, Lucky Child. One more thing, though, about that time when you're so young. And you use these words at the beginning of your new book. You look back at writing First They Killed My Father and say that book was written in anger. You were the angry child as opposed to the lucky child at that point. Is that gone now, that anger?
That anger is still there. It's hard for it to go away because everywhere I turn, in Rwanda, in Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Kosovo, I'm still seeing and all these atrocious, you know, crimes against humanity, mm-hmm. and war crimes everywhere, and yet we kept saying not ever again, never again, and so I've been able to turn that anger, not inward at myself, not inward at the guilt that I have for surviving, and instead outward to you know, these mass murderers in all these countries that are committing crimes against humanity to this date.
You know, the question that we're asking our listeners to join us on is, you know, can stories make a difference? Can books make a difference? Can, you know, what does it take to get people to pay attention? At a fairly simple level, First They Killed My Father did make a difference. You've heard from so many people over the past 5 years since you wrote it.
Yes. It's amazing. When I first put it out, I was hoping it would just sell 10 copies. That was my goal. But then I would be a published author, and that would be my pedigree to go and meet senators and congressmen and policymakers. And I've been so fortunate and blessed that through word of mouth, it's now done really well, and it's published in 12 different countries and translated into 9 different languages. Groups like in Australia, there was a high school group that read it for a required reading class, and a group of young women came together and formed a group called Bombs Be Gone. They were all musicians, and they put together concerts and ended up raising over $60,000 to help clear minefields in Cambodia. There's a group in Canada called Grapes for Humanities who picked up my book and really wanted to get involved with Cambodia. And what they do is they enjoy wine, so they did wine auctions and wine dinner and raised funds to help our centers in Cambodia, where we manufacture prosthetic limbs for victims of landmines, to help them walk and not just survive the war but thrive in peace. And I've also heard from women from South Korea and writers formerly from Rwanda who came up and said on a personal level it helped them connect it to their stories.
So Connection listeners, do the stories make a difference? Do they make a difference to you? And if they do make a difference, why do we still have Rwanda? Why do we still have Darfur? Why does that continue to happen? My guest is Luang Ong. She is the author of First They Killed My Father, and a new book called Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. And we're going to hear about that reunion when we come back after the break. But it's also an opportunity for you to join us at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Luang Ong. She is the author of the book, First They Killed My Father, and most recently, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. On our website at theconnection.org, a series of photographs of the family members in Luang's family, people who were killed by the Khmer Rouge, people who are still with us and living in America and living in Cambodia. At one point, I thought your family was going to become so spread out that you would never reunite with anyone. I can't imagine 10 years old getting off an airplane in Vermont, USA, from a refugee camp and then ever making a life for yourself. But in fact, you did that you did that with ease. It wasn't easy, was it?
It wasn't, but it was fun.
there's your story that's in the new book, and in parallel chapters there's the story of Ju, who is 2 years older than you, is that right?
Yes.
Is she still in Phnom Penh?
No, she's still in a village.
In a village, sorry. Yeah. But you met her in Phnom Penh. Your reunion was there,
yes,
at the airport?
Yes. There's only one airport in Phnom Penh at the time, and there was only one airport, and so we met there.
Why did you choose to tell your story, high school, college, the work that you're doing now as spokesperson for the Cambodia Fund, alongside Ju's story?
I guess the last couple of years, it just dawned on me that everywhere I turn in the media, in the newspaper, on television, there have been a lot of talks about wars being over, where conflicts are ending here and there and everywhere. And I know for a fact of people who went through it, whether they live still in the war-torn country or have left and been fortunate to live elsewhere, it's not over if you went through it. It's not over if you're a soldier or a civilian or a journalist. It stays with you. And often, people focus on surviving wars, and they've forgotten that surviving peacetime can be just as difficult, and the people who have to survive the peacetime need assistance, and they need to be heard, and they need to be seen just as well.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we talk about surviving war and this notion we have that wars. And I'm wondering, Luang, if I can ask you to read a bit from your book, because your writing illustrates so beautifully what it is that you're talking about. There are a couple of segments here that I'd like to hear back to back because of the way that they link your story and Ju's story. I don't want to give it away, so why don't I ask you to start. This is 4th of July celebration where we begin, and it's your first one in America?
Yes, yes. This is...
You're how old here? You're 10?
I was 10 years old. Okay. Didn't speak any English.
I keep forgetting how young you are through this whole book. But
yeah. I arrived in America on June 10th. And our sponsors in Vermont didn't know a lot about us. And we did not know a lot about them. And they wanted to share with us what life in America was going to be like. And so they took us to the 4th of July fireworks. After a few moments of searching, Joe finds a bench in the front first row with room enough for all of us. All around, children scream with joy. Their arms shoot out sparklers and flap like dragonflies. Somewhere in the distance, a band plays a song I've never heard. The drums and the cymbals roll and clash, lifting me into the air before the tuba drags me back down to the ground. Above us, the stars twinkle like the eyes of the gods, blinking in and out as if spying on our festivities. It's almost time, it's almost time, the crowd whispers. The crowd huddles in the dark, forming bumps on the field resembling burial mounds. It's almost time, the crowds exhale. My skin moistens from the sounds of crackling gunshots from afar. Any moment now. The swarm murmurs as the excitement grows. Perspirations form above my lip. I wrap my arms around myself, my hands rubbing my skin to keep warm. Suddenly a cannonball shoots into the air. The whiz of its flight and brilliant explosions hover above me. My hand clasps over my ears, my eyes shut, my jaw clenches so tightly I feel the muscle of my cheeks cramp up. In the sky the rockets explode. Its deafening sound vibrates in my heart. Then another hand cannon hurls above the crowd. I brace myself for the oncoming war. The smell of burnt powder, the brightness of the bombs, and the haze of the smoke are so terrifying that even the stars leave us and disappear into their black holes. And somewhere in the crowd, a baby screams. Its cries jump into my head and are trapped in my skull, flooding my senses. Another explosion sends me trying to scurry under the bench, but Meng grabs my arms and holds me in my seat. I want to be a good girl. I want to be strong. So I press my body against the back wall as more flare shoots into the night and bursts into fire showers. I flatten my body into the bench and try to disappear into the wood. In my seat, my throat closes as I gasp for air. Suddenly I'm outside of time and space in a world where Cambodia and America collide, with me stuck somewhere in the middle. A baby screams as the soldiers reach into the bomb shelter and pull out a woman. Her clothes are black and dirty, and her face is muddy. She clutches the baby to her breast and begs for mercy, taking me back to the death of Ma and my sister Gik. All of a sudden, my world goes red, and I'm back in America, disoriented and terrified. As the sky continues to explode, I count quietly under my breath, inhaling the falling ashes and damp earth through my nose and mouth. 1, 2, 3... I breathe as pictures of Cambodia and America are superimposed on top of one another. My eyes shut. I pray the bombs will not hit my shelter and bury me alive.
That's Luang Ang reading from her new book, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. Now, the sister that you left behind separated when you were 10. She was 12. Is that right?
Yes.
You were how long before you saw each other again?
It would be 15 years before we would meet again.
And in most of that time, as you say, she was in a village or in living the village life in Cambodia.
Yeah. While I was in America, adapting to life, playing soccer, learning about snow, my sister was in Cambodia trying to grow her own food and on a land filled with landmines, trying to survive and living in a village where there's no electricity, no running waters.
Can I ask you to read a scene from that life of your sister, Ju?
Yes. And My sister also, for her life every day, she had to be careful because her next step could be her last due to landmines. Ju has come to buy palm fruits and baby crab seasoned with spices and deep fried to a crimson red. The few dozen vendors call out to her and a handful of other early buyers. "Buy from me, sister," a boy calls, bringing over his baskets of slippery black eels. "You bought from him last week," a girl shows Ju her bucket of live fish splashing in an inch of dirty water. "Buy from me this week, sister." Ju is staring at the girl's fish when suddenly the earth shakes with a loud explosion that chases the birds into the sky. Instantly, Ju's feet burn and her toes sting as they've been pierced by dry splinter wood. Next to her, a girl ducks, hugging her basket to her chest. Around Ju, many villagers scream and run into their homes. For a moment, Ju closes her eye tightly and crouches low to the ground. When she opens them, she is crawling on her hands and knees toward a nearby tree, hoping to find shelter. "Another mine exploded," a villager shouts. "The man on the trail, he's hurt," another woman yells as she runs back to the market. From her tree, Ju sees a man lying on the ground in a storm of red dust. With a dazed look, he props himself on his knee, tentatively stands on his one leg, and lifts his bike up. Slowly, he pushes his bicycle forward and hops the rest of the way into the village market. A chill runs down Ju's spine when she sees the man passes, his face smeared with blood, his eyes big like crabs, and his dark shirt wet with brushes and twigs stuck from all over. As he passes Ju, his left leg pushes him up, while his right leg drags in a dirt, dripping thick stream of blood as it goes. Ju suppresses a scream when she sees that his right leg is shredded and hanging by the skin of its stump, his foot only bits of charred skin and melting flesh. When he passes his crowd, his face is ashen, but calm. Then abruptly, he falls to the ground. His body convulses for a few minutes and then is still. "Does anyone know his family?" a man shouts, approaching. "He's from another village. Someone has to tell his family he's dead." The first man says this. "He looks as if he didn't know what happened," a girl whispers. "He was living his last win," an old woman tells her, referring for the moment when his life flashed before his eyes. When blood returns to her warm face, Ju walks away from the crowd. In a daze, she continues her shopping for the family's eggs, chickens, and potatoes with her eyes wide open.
"He was living his last wind," is a phrase there. Is that a Cambodian phrase to refer to the moment of death? He was living his last wind?
Yes, it's a Cambodian phrase. It's a literal translation of a Cambodian phrase referring to when life flashes before your eyes.
1-800-423-8255, your chance to join my conversation with Luang Ung. And we're going to go to Manchester, Massachusetts for our first call. Margaret's with us. Hi, Margaret.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks for calling.
I just wanted to speak to the author. I have read her book. I was in Cambodia 5 years ago and again 2 years ago. My sister is the company director for the Cambodia Trust, and they make prostheses for children and adults who have been the victims of landmines. And I just wanted to share with her an experience I had, which was very moving, and it has stayed with me. And I had gone out into the provinces with my sister to visit and to bring the children into the clinics to be fitted. And there was a young Cambodian lady with us, and she was sitting in the back of the SUV, and she was very, very quiet. And after about an hour in the car, I noticed we were going through very flat land with rice paddies, but away in the distance was what looked like a beautiful hillside. And I commented, you know, how wonderful that was right out there in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden, out of the back of the car, this little voice came, and she looked over and she said, "My mother, my sister, my brother, my uncles, my aunts are all over there. That's where they left them." And it was such it was so moving to hear this, because I had been to Tusling, which was the prison there, and I had looked around everywhere, but to be actually within a foot of a survivor of this horror, to me, it's just stayed with me forever. I'm never, ever going to forget it. But the question I had was, I found it very difficult to understand that the high schools over there, that there is no education about the Pol Pot era. I believe it's beginning now, but nobody talks about it. Nobody wants to talk about it, and I found that disturbing.
Is that true, that it's still not taught in the schools in the way that we understand it? Or
It's not taught in school until you reach grade 12. And Cambodian has a 70% illiteracy rate. Very few people reach grade 12. It's not taught, and it's very difficult because there are students who want to know, who want to learn, who go to their principal and their teachers, and they're told to go to the genocide museum or to go to the foreigners who can talk about it. I think it is a very difficult topic to discuss.
How much of that is politics? How much of that is the fact that the man who is the Prime Minister of Cambodia, Hun Sen, is himself a former regimental commander of the Khmer Rouge? Is that the reason why it's not discussed?
Yeah, I actually don't know. I've never met Hun Sen, and I would believe that some of that's politics. But I think also there's a fact that we just don't know how to teach this. How do you teach a country where 60% of its populations are 24 and under, and the 5 million survivors are still so traumatized that not only do they not teach in school, they don't talk about it within their own families?
The story that you tell of your own family, at one point, one of your uncles, Uncle Leung,
yes,
I think, turns to you and says, I'm glad you did this, because we're not even telling our own children about this.
Yeah, I can talk to it. Can talk about this with people I don't know, in classes, with Americans, and with my nieces of the new generation, Ungs. But I cannot talk about this with my sister, with my brother. I can interview them and be very professional about it. It's heartbreaking when I talk about it with my sister and I see the tears, and I see my grandmother rubbing her eyes with both her palms, and I can see my grandmother rubbing her chest above her shirt in a circular motion, as just to massage her heart to keep it going. It's hard, and it stops you in your track.
I'm trying to understand if the people in Cambodia are still so traumatized by what the Khmer Rouge did to that country, how then you get beyond that to a stage where you're having a tribunal, you're actually holding people to account? Does one have to come in front of the other? How does that work?
Yeah. And then it's 30 years later now since the Khmer Rouge takeover, and 25 years passed since the Khmer Rouge were defeated by the Vietnamese. It took time, and also right after the Khmer Rouge, during the Khmer Rouge, the among the 2 million killed of the 7 million population were the elites, and many of them were the teachers, the doctors, the lawyers, the writers, and I think Cambodia also had to wait for new generations of citizens, of leaders, who wants to know and who can know, and it took Cambodia, I believe, a bit of time to go beyond just surviving, to now be in a place where they can believe in the future.
Have you read your book to your sister, Ju?
Well, my book has been turned into an audio version, and it was played on to Cambodian national radio 30 minutes a day for 3 months, and also serialized in a Cambodian newspaper. So she's heard it, and many people in the country's heard it on the radio. With that said, when we talk about it, we laugh, because to cry is just too painful.
Stories can make a difference when they are told and people get a chance to listen to them, but how much of a difference do they make if the lessons of Cambodia taught the world nothing about Bosnia and Rwanda and Kosovo and Darfur Sudan? 1-800-423-TALKS, the number to join my conversation this hour with Luang Ung. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Thank you. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Luang Ung was 5 years old when the Khmer Rouge took over the streets of Phnom Penh. That was exactly 30 years ago. 2 years after that, at age seven, she was sent to a labor camp to be trained as a child soldier. When she was 10 years old, she came to the United States. She now is the spokesperson for the Cambodia Fund. It's an organization that helps victims of landmines. If you're interested in finding out more about her work today, you can find links on our website. We're at theconnection.org. You can also see photographs of Luang and her family through the years. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. We're going to Charlottesville, Virginia, and Abu is with us on the line. Hi, Abu.
Hello, Mr. Gordon. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for calling.
I want to commend you on your show. It's a great show, and I want to commend your guest, too. It was great to listen to her. I am from Africa, and as she read abstracts from her book, she just reminded me of some of the things that have been going on in my country, Sierra Leone. And it is awful. When she talks about the babies and the bombs dropping and the landmines, I just reflect back. I was one of the lucky ones who was not there during the war, but my mother, who is presently with me, went through the same ordeal. Fortunately, none of my family members was killed, but as my mother told me stories, how she escaped with my little brother in the jungle, laying down for days without food and trying to crawl in the middle of the night just to escape the rebels, it just reminded me of what she went through.
Abu, can I ask you a question here?
Yeah.
One of the things that Luang writes about in her book is that in spite of everything that she went through as a child, on all the starvation and all the death and the killing that she witnessed, there's a part of her that's still guilty because she survived and so many other people did not. I wonder if your mother also has kind of that strange feeling of guilt because she's still alive.
Of course, of course. Not only my mother, even me. My mother always talked to me about the war, how she felt bad. Most of her neighbors and my cousins, my uncles were killed right in front of her. I even felt the same way. Unfortunately, I've been in the United States for long. Just before the war, I left the country.
Yeah.
But most of the people that I went to school with, most of my brothers, most of my brother's friends, the people I grew up with, are not there anymore. And then I kept asking myself a question. Why was I not there? People are killed. My best friends were killed. I was not there to make a difference. And at the same time, you look back and say, where were the superpowers? Where was America? Where was France, England, who were supposed to stop this war before everything become like the way it is now? And I don't know. Is it because there's no vested interest in the country or what? I think sometimes this problem could have been stopped before it went too far.
I want to bring Luang back with those same questions of guilt when Abu talks about saying, well, I could have been there, I could have done something. I mean, you're so small. Do you still, though, have guilt?
You know, I do still have guilt. I'm very lucky. I live a good life. I have good friends. But for me, you know, I went through a period when I said, where was the Americans and the human rights worker? Now I ask myself, and I think that we should all ask ourselves, instead of looking at just countries and governments, what about looking at us? Where are you now in your life that will allow you to be of some assistance to Sierra Leone? That has saved me, being involved in activism, going back to Cambodia over 25 years. At first, I went back as a Cambodian daughter, a sister, an aunt. Now I go back as a citizen, looking for ways where I can be of service to help those who survived the wars have a chance to survive the peace. So in addition to, and we should definitely keep pressure on the government to fix the mess that they started, but also, we now have a lot of power as individuals. This world is made up of 6 billion people, not just big governmental organizations or governments, but individual people, and we all do something. We can change the world. I believe that firmly.
Was there a moment, one moment, when you came to that conclusion? When you, I don't know if it was seeing the victims of the landmines in Cambodia or, you know, sitting here in America, because that's a conclusion that a lot of people have not yet reached in their lives, that one person can make a difference. What was it for you?
I don't think there was any one moment, but it was a series of moments. When I was growing up in Cambodia, I didn't want, in America, I didn't want anything to do with Cambodia. I wanted to leave it as far behind as I could so I could live my American dream good life. And then I went back to Cambodia that first time in 1995, and I saw just the amputees and disabled people, and it's insane to me that those who survive wars are having such a hard time surviving the peace. And my father and mother sacrificed so much that I could be here, and all the survivors, their parents, their family members sacrificed so much so they could live. And when I came back and I started meeting people like Bobby Mueller, a Vietnam vet who's paraplegic and who started the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation and is now working in Kosovo, in Bosnia, in Cambodia, in Vietnam, helping victims of landmines and victims of war. And from there, I met churchgoers and politicians and everyday people who have gotten involved in whatever capacity they could. And finally, it dawned on me, people did get involved. 25 years ago, I was living on the streets, eating out of garbage cans, fighting would-be rapists, and here I am today. Now, I didn't get here on my own. It took a little bit of reflection, and it took a lot of realizations and an attitude of gratitude. I didn't get here on my own. Somebody went to the refugee camps. Somebody helped me with blankets and medicines and filling out papers, refugee papers, because I didn't know how to write. When I came to America, somebody taught me English. When I went to college, somebody helped me fill out scholarship applications, so I was able to go to college. None of us got here on our own. A lot of the people who've helped, their names and faces, I might never meet and never know, but I am so grateful. And I hope that my actions, helping the prosthetic centers and the Cambodians, majority of them, the 15,000 people we've assisted with new arms and legs and wheelchairs in Cambodia, they don't know who I am. But it doesn't matter.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston for our next call. Sam's on the line. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
Thank you for calling. Tell me what you're thinking.
Thank you. I've been listening to the news for all along, and I just would like to call and support the author, because I'm one of the Cambodian that escaped the killing field, and most of my family member, my grandmother, my uncles, my aunt, my cousins, you know, like almost everybody. When we escaped, there's like 60 of them, and by the time the Khmer Rouge have done, when the Vietnamese took over, there's about 10 of them left. And now my family, one of the lucky ones, which is we did the same, like her family. We escaped from one village to the next one. You know, keep escaping. That's how my family get away. Only my father was killed. And that considered to be lucky, because most of my aunt family, you know, uncle and everybody wiped out. And I remember when they killed my father, my mom cried to me and said, told me the story. And finally she said, you know what, it's good for him. We just hope that he dies fast, because to die is a lot better than living. And I agree.
I am so sorry, Bong. I'm so sorry, Boo, that you went through that. I went through times when I thought to die was a lot easier than to live. But, you know, I am so glad I lived. I'm so glad when I was going through that, when I was going through my depression in my puberty years in Vermont, that there were people out there who showed me life is worth it. It is a gift. It is a gift that if we live it consciously, if we can take it and do what we can to help others. Look, Boo, you and I, in America, we are so privileged. We are so blessed. We have so much power. And we could do so much to assist other people. For me, what has saved my life from the time when I wanted to die is my work with activism and my trips going back to Cambodia and doing what I can for Cambodia and the Cambodians who are still there. And and that's made all the difference. So I really encourage you to get more involved with the communities and to find out if you could be of service.
Yeah. You know, I tried that. 2 years ago, I even went to Cambodia and met one of the top leader in Pol Pot regime. His name is Khieu Somphan, you know, right?
Yes.
Yes, he wrote the book, and after I read his book, I went to see him and spoke to him. And I just feel so angry that time because he said that everything he didn't know. Like, he's very innocent. He didn't know about all this killing, about all that. And what surprised me is he still speak good about the Khmer Rouge.
And I was just going to say that I've met politicians, and very few of the politicians I've met have actually inspired me and made me feel good. But I also have met Cambodians who came to the center with no legs and walking out with two prosthetic legs into their farms and their communities and their school. Meeting the Cambodian people have given more hope than meeting of many of the government officials in Cambodia.
Sam, it's Dick here. I've got a question for you. There is talk that soon a tribunal will be pulled together, and people like Khieu Somphan and Nuan Che, Tamok, some of the people who, the half a dozen or so, who are in jail or under house arrest, will be taken before judges and be called to answer for their crimes. Will it make a difference to you?
Is it me or her?
No, you first.
Yes, you know, actually, every day now, not ever a single day that I don't think about it. If the question asks me what is my life fulfillment, I would say I cannot die without seeing those people bring to justice. I have to hang on to life. I cannot die before that. This is my last wish of my life, and I know a lot of Cambodian people that went through feel the same. We want to see that, but again, it's hard because, like you know, the Prime Minister now, Hun Sen, is one of them.
Yeah, we were talking about that.
Yeah, so I don't think it's hard to bring like 100% justice or good justice for the people because it's hard because the government is one of them.
Luangang, the tribunal, if it happens, is only going to talk to or call before it the leaders. That would mean that the Khmer Rouge soldiers who were jailers, who were interrogators, who were taking people's houses, they remain free and they'll be free. So, will the tribunal make a difference?
To me, it will. And I think to a lot of Cambodians, it will. Not to have a tribunal is not an option. 2 million people dead. Many people were responsible. With that said, I have a lot of sympathies to the many lower Khmer Rouge members who were part of the regime. As a child soldier, after both my parents were killed, I was a part of the regime. If my war hadn't ended, I have no question that I would have been an efficient killer. I would have been trained and brainwashed to hate and to hurt. Could and should I have been punished for that? I was 8 years old. How many of the Khmer Rouge lower level members were so young and so desperate and brainwashed? I don't know. And yet, you know, I would just be satisfied and would settle for, if not the 15 or 30 members, but you know, maybe the 5 to 10 members of the upper echelon of the Khmer Rouge leadership.
So something symbolic then, at least that symbolic ruling that what they did was wrong.
It's more than just what they did and why they did it, but it's also for the world to see that it happened, to give us a place in the world and a voice in the world and to be acknowledged. I mean, this Cambodian, there's still discussions whether or not it was a genocide. What happened? How it happened? And for us, it's also education. This is the tribunal, I think, is the best educational source we have for the next generation. So they get to hear this. So that if they don't get it from school, they can get it elsewhere, and hopefully not, the mistake won't be repeated in their generation.
Sam, you agree with that, that it's important not just for you, but that the world stop, pay attention, and listen to what the tribunal would do?
Yes, I agree 100%.
I want to thank you for calling. It was nice to have you with us.
Thank you. And thank you to the author. I'm looking forward to read her next book, too.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm interested, Luang, when you go back. You go back to Cambodia lots now. You've been there, what, dozens of times in your work as a landmine activist. And you visit family, and you are this public figure there. Do you see a country that still is in some way crippled by that war? Do you see a country that is, you know, where your children's sisters are looking ahead to a life that doesn't have those memories?
Yeah. And I see a country that is slowly and steadily moving forward. Many of the people are still suffering from the legacy of the war, and the current government and its corruptions and poverties and lack of health care. There's a lot of problems with Cambodia still, but it's a problem that's moving forward. And from a personal experience, just my sister, who kept all her children so close to her, because in the back of her mind for years she was still thinking the Khmer should come back to power, and they didn't want to be separated the way many family and many Cambodians were separated when on April 17, 1975. Just 2 years ago, just 1.5 year ago, she allowed her children to leave the village to go to the city so they could get a high school degree. In the village, there are no high schools. Education stopped at grade 8. And so now, I've got an apartment in Cambodia where it's filled with 7, 8 Cambodian girls and boys just trying to get a high school degree who are in their 20s.
And you own a piece of the killing fields, too. You own a little piece of land.
I own a piece of Cambodia.
Must mean a lot to you.
It will always be my heart and a part of my soul.
Thanks so much for coming in. It was great to have you here.
Thank you.
Luang Ung, author of Lucky Child, a daughter of Cambodia, reunites with the sister she left behind. Her first book is called First They Killed My Father. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.